Economist Larry Michel has been a fixture at the Economic Policy Institute for 30 years. In that time, he has become a leading voice for improving the lives of working class people and built EPI into a powerful, influential player in Washington. In his final days as president of EPI, I spoke to Michel about the tax cut bill that Republicans crafted at the end of 2017 and about the policy agenda that he believes America's working class needs. I want to start out, since the tax bill is the hot topic right now, I want to run a thesis past you, and I'd like you to unpack it, rebut it, whatever is appropriate. But this is kind of one scenario I see unfolding. You and others have made the case that this tax scam is going to not only not filter down to workers in terms of increased jobs, but will in fact worsen income inequality. At the same time, we have a Federal Reserve coming in and increasing interest rates at a time when the Trump administration says it wants to stimulate the economy even more. And this tax cut that will primarily go to the wealthy, benefits, combined with increasing interest rates and the failed promises of economic stimulus, strikes me as a train wreck.
Yeah, no, let me comment on one of the broader things and then get to that. And that is that, a central part of my work, and actually the reason I went to grad school, was to understand income distribution, understand how to generate higher wages. Mm-hmm. And, I've been part of a debate over decades about what has happened to the wages and benefits of various types of workers, and the typical worker, has it grown? Why was there an increase in inequalities of wages and benefits? Was there stagnation? What's the role of productivity? What's the role of unions? What's the role of trade? Skills, all that sort of stuff. And I always wanted to elevate the concerns about people's paychecks as the salient economic issue. And what's really interesting, moving into the tax realm, is there was discussion in the both Republican and Democratic primaries about acknowledging wage stagnation, mm-hmm. which is also interesting because, the main critics of our work, and they're like full-time trolls, coming from the Heritage Foundation or the Manhattan Institute or AEI, kind of denying wage stagnation. Now, these people have kind of shut up since then, because their politicians have been talking about wages. So we didn't get in the presidential campaign, a debate on which team is going to do better at raising wages. And that's because it's not clear there was much policy debate, period, et cetera. But what's interesting is that there's so much of a dedication of the Trump team to link everything they're doing to jobs and good jobs and wages, something which Democrats have not always done for mysterious reasons, contrary to all the advice that I and other progressives have given them. So we have this tax bill, which they promote as providing a $4,000 wage increase for workers, based on giving money away to corporations and changing the international scheme of taxing corporate profits, which the polls show that not many people buy it, even Republicans. But it's interesting that transformation has happened. And still, you know, I don't, you know, Democrats still don't get it so much. You know, they will talk somewhat about good jobs, but let me just say something more about the wages. You know, we believe you should, and we believe you can, you know, think about economic policy through the framework of what is going to lift wages for the vast majority. So yes, we are for lower unemployment. We are for better monetary policy that allows the robust recovery to keep on expanding, so to make sure that you know, traditionally disadvantaged groups, low-wage workers, minorities, you know, get to benefit from the recovery. But it's also true that you know, a true sign of a robust recovery is pretty rapid wage growth, and we don't see wages growing that much faster than inflation, even with, you know, roughly 4% unemployment. And, you know, you have a trend of productivity of whatever you want to believe it is, 1 or 1.5%. And so you should be getting wage increases at least equal to inflation plus productivity. And we're nowhere near that, which is a sign that we don't have full employment. Okay, so get back to your tax question. So yes, the first order effects of the tax bill will be to provide more money to those who need it the least, corporations and the rich, and a lot of tax scams will emerge via pass-throughs expanding, you know, more people doing their businesses as pass-through to pay their taxes as individuals, you know, which is done by hedge funds and law firms, and, you know, it's not just, you know, individual entrepreneurs. You know, it will raise the deficits, which is not, I think, the biggest problem with it. It's just that we don't want to raise the deficit to give money to the corporations and the rich. And that is the weakest way to try to stimulate jobs and growth. You know, common sense dictates that this is a scam, and it's, you know, and I, you know, when I can explain things without going into detailed economics, I always think it's better. So we have some of the highest after-tax corporate profits in historical terms right now. Mm-hmm. Companies have a ton of cash on hand. There's nothing stopping them from using that cash to invest. But we have investment rates that are very low. And we have interest rates that are very low. So the ability to borrow money to invest is, you know, historically, you know, if there was a profitable opportunity, you would think that companies would be undertaking it and creating jobs. And so, you know, I mean, you know, the conservatives and the Republicans, you know, cutting taxes for corporations and the rich are the policy that is always the highest priority, whether you're in the middle of a recession or you're at the top of a recovery. I mean, the argument, you know, it's an ever-ready, all-purpose cure-all for any disease that you think you have or might have.
That 19th century bottle of snake oil that cures every disease.
Yes.
Including ones that you don't have.
In fact, you know, given that, you know, George W. Bush did it in 2001 and 2003 when we had, you know, a collapsing stock market and we had high unemployment. And he said, well, you know, that's when we need tax cuts. The fact that they're doing it now at 4% unemployment tells you everything you need to know. And yes, you are right that it's kind of bizarre. It is true that the Federal Reserve Board can take contrary actions, which will squash any of the job creation that could happen from increasing the deficit through the tax bill.
So let me ask this question.
But you know, I think various people think that there's a mixed. Trump himself is very mixed on monetary policy. sometimes he seems like a hard money guy like Paul Ryan, and sometimes he's like a real estate guy who's like, well, we want low interest rates, you know. So he goes all over the place.
True.
You know, sometimes he worries about the strength of the dollar, and sometimes he doesn't. So it's hard to know, to see a latent economic philosophy there.
So, but let me ask, so what does the economy look like a year from now if the tax bill passes?
That's a good question. Well, I think some people point out that we're going to see a huge increase in the stock market as companies buy back a lot of shares. That won't benefit workers. That will generate, I do an annual report on CEO compensation. So the one I do in June 2019 is going to report on an awesome surge in executive pay in 2018, mm-hmm. based on the rise of the stock market and their stock options. Mm. So
There are guys like you who have, I'm sure you have an retirement plan or a pension something that...
I get a 401k. It might help me, but, you know.
Yeah, but you know, how many people have 401ks? You guys have done some excellent research on
that issue. Yeah, so the rising stock market is not a sign that the economy is doing well, and it's not something that's going to benefit, you know, hardly any significant group. So there are only a third or so of households that actually hold any stock,
right?
Yeah. Or any significant amount of stock, like at least $5,000 or $10,000 worth of stock. And most, half the workforce doesn't even have any pension, any employer-related pension scheme whatsoever.
Right.
Or, you know, like a 401k or anything like that. So, you know, this will help the already wealthy and perhaps some of the professional class that does have the 403Bs, 401Ks. But the typical worker, they try to claim that it's going to help and your typical truck driver, no.
And in fact, if you have a stock market that is increasingly unmoored to the actual performance of the economy, that sets you up for another 2008
situation. You could have a speculative bubble. 2000, 2001, 2008. You really can have, if the stock market takes a huge dive, it can really suppress consumption and throw us into a recession. Yes. So, the underlying profitability, I mean, the after-tax profits, you know, may go up, so there may be some small basis for the stock market to grow, but a lot of stock buybacks is not a recipe for growth.
Now, you said a few moments ago that the Democrats don't... What would you do if you were Senator Lawrence Michel? What would you be saying?
Majority leader? Senator Lawrence Michel from Pennsylvania, my home state. I would make sure that, I'm a big believer that it's really important to address people's living standards and to talk about wages and jobs. And let me be really clear. This is not about the white working class. But it's about the working class. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, people don't seem to be able to appreciate that Hispanics and black people are quintessentially working class communities, people who are concerned with job quality and social services and education and health care as much as any other working class community. And so... to focus on these issues is not to ignore those communities, or to say that we don't also have to address other mm-hmm. issues like criminal justice reform, mass incarceration, or immigration, or or discrimination. Mm-hmm. But it's to say that to motivate people to come out and vote, to participate in our democracy, to appreciate that economic policy can benefit their family, mm-hmm. and can benefit their family even if they are not low wage, right? In other mm-hmm. words, I think, many people will support a high minimum wage, but they think that doesn't affect their family. I think they're wrong, because on the minimum wage in particular, maybe it's a tangent, but you can do whatever you want with all this. Ask another question. And
okay.
The answer. But the Fight for 15 and the current proposal in Congress for $15 in 2024 would yield wage increases for roughly 30% of the workforce. I mean, that's a huge amount. And so
probably more than I actually have not heard a Republican claim about how many workers would actually get a wage increase from the tax bill. But you're saying a $15 minimum wage
in 2024. Would
do more for workers than even what the Republicans claim their tax
bill. Oh, it'll definitely
bill.
Do more for people in the bottom 60%.
Mm-hmm.
The minimum wage, obviously affects like the bottom 30% of wage earners, but those wage earners live in all sorts of different households, not just those that are poor or low income. There's a lot of working class families that may have one minimum wage worker and one other worker, right? Mm-hmm. And they're struggling, and they have a total household income of 50 or 60,000, but that's important. It's the Republicans frequently, when I've gone to debates, and conservatives say they refer to minimum wage earners as secondary earners. That's an old term that went out of fashion, but they're bringing it back. And what is a secondary earner? It means it's the earner in the family that doesn't provide the greatest amount of earnings. And who is that? Well, that's women. What they're really saying is they don't really care about the minimum wage because it's helping women. That's what that is. It's very directly, and because, it's only important to like lift the wages of guys. Well, guys live with women, and a lot more guys are in jobs affected by the minimum wage now than it used to be.
Well, it's kind of stunning that a lot of these members of Congress will make their argument, because all they would have to do, particularly a lot of these southern states right now, is look at their own friggin' congressional districts.
Yeah.
Yes. Look at who's in the dollar stores. Look at who's in the Walmart. Look,
Yeah. No, exactly.
Even in some of these manufacturing jobs that we've been fighting to bring back, not all of those jobs are high-wage jobs. A lot of them are low-wage jobs right now.
Right. Right. So, let's go over the program, okay? So I think it's really important, yeah. And I'm just putting it within the debates on the center left about what the thing is. It's not, that's not race or class. I think that's
right.
The stupidest divide I've ever heard, because they're so inherently intermingled. I mean, the way we allocate people according to class is by race. to pick a race versus class, it's we have a class.
But there is a structural racism debate that we really need to have in this country.
Absolutely, absolutely, and absolutely, and there's nothing, and it needs to go alongside the struggle to achieve improved living standards for the entire working class and low and moderate wage workers within it, who are going to be disproportionately minority. So, we believe that there's an agenda for an economic policy that could readily, lift wages. And so item number one is appropriate policies to create jobs and get to and maintain full employment. That's the appropriate Federal Reserve monetary policy. You know, that's to have a wave of infrastructure spending that's going to, you know, create jobs. But it's also direct targeted jobs at communities who have high unemployment, even when there is 4% unemployment. And those are disproportionately minority communities. And, you know, those communities, even when we're at 4% unemployment, let's just say that's full employment, or 3.5, I mean, they will have, you know, unemployment twice as high and still be living in a recession. In their community, there's a recession.
What? Why are we not having a conversation about targeted unemployment
jobs,
remedies?
Yeah. Well, we are, in a sense that there's a lot of proposals out there about a job guarantee. But this is, I think it hasn't, the debate around these issues about having a targeted job program or a job guarantee, which are different sort of things, you know, hasn't necessarily gotten outside of the sort of policy intelligentsia too much. But I think that we're going to see a lot of discussion and development of such proposals. So that's what, you know, first and foremost, you want to give everyone who wants a job. And by doing that, you know, you want a situation where employers are chasing after workers, not workers chasing after employers. Mm-hmm. When employers are chasing after workers, wages go up. When that happens, their wages are going to go up fastest for low-wage workers and moderate-wage workers. I mean, for high-wage workers, the unemployment among white-collar workers will be 2% or less. Mm-hmm. You know, they already have full employment, you mm-hmm. know, for sure. So, okay, so that's one set of policies. Two other policies, you know, I think are essential for supporting wage growth. What, you know, one is we need to rebuild the collective bargaining system.
Right.
That'll benefit not only just people in unions, but people that, if we rebuild it, will be able to benefit directly from collective bargaining. But the third group is that when collective bargaining is strong, workers in non-union employers benefit as well, because their employers will follow the lead of the employers where collective bargaining is setting the standards. The reason being is that their employers will be may not wish the union to come to them, and secondly, they want to make sure that their workers don't shift from them to the better paid union sector. So history speaks very loudly that when you rebuild collective bargaining, it's not just for union workers, that all workers tend to benefit if they're in occupations and industries that have high union representation. So that's a big item, and that's a big topic about how to do that. And I don't think we will ever get robust middle-class wage growth or have the vibrant democracy that we need without reestablishing collective bargaining. Okay, another related thing is there's a whole set of what I would call labor standards issues. You know, the leading one, obviously, is a higher minimum wage. We need to restore the overtime threshold. There used to be a lot of salaried workers who were eligible for overtime, meaning that when they worked more than 40 hours, they got paid time and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Now many salaried workers work more than 40 hours a week and they don't get any pay for their work past 40. You know, there are issues of what we call day one fairness. That is, when workers show up on the job, they're already put at a disadvantage. Some of them are misclassified as self-employed instead of as workers. They sign forced arbitration agreements, meaning that any dispute between them and their employer has to be settled in private arbitration tribunals that are overseen by the corporations themselves, and frequently done and can't be done on a class action basis. In other words, if you're being ripped off by your employer who forces you to do work off the clock, it may not make sense for you to have a suit individually, but if you could collaborate with hundreds or thousands of fellow workers, you'd have enough to pay the lawyer and get the money back and stop the company from doing that. And so they, 56% of workers now sign these forced arbitration agreements that keep them from going to federal court. And this is a big problem in this day and age of sensitivity to sexual harassment. A lot of those in forced arbitration also sign away their right to do class action. Other people sign non-compete agreements, which is ridiculous. You know, that blue-collar workers somehow are, prevented from, or think they are prevented from taking another job because of a non-compete agreement. States that outlaw it, like California.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and even in areas, I think I've seen an article about fast food chains.
Yeah. Jimmy John's, made people sign non-compete agreements. Sandwich makers. Anyway, so, there was not a level playing field from the day you show up. And that is a problem. We need to have standards that have all employers providing adequate overtime, adequate wages, paid sick leave, family leave, et cetera. And that helps make sure that, the broad working class benefits from economic growth. So those are three, so the labor standards, the collective bargaining, the lower unemployment. And the fourth thing I'll say is, we can't, we live in a system that has been constructed to allow the top 1% to skim off just a huge share of all the income growth. And unless we do things that kind of limit them from skimming it all off, it's two sides of the same coin. We need to strengthen those from below to get more, and we need to weaken those from above from dipping down and taking the money. And that has to do with dealing with the financial sector and the financial transactions tax, of dealing with CEO corporate pay and curtailing that. Those two things, the growth of the financial sector and their wages and the growth of CEO pay, explains, about two-thirds of the growth of higher incomes in the and wages in the top 1%. Mm-hmm. So we have to really go after those things.
And yet, when you look at the political landscape for just about everything that you've laid out in the last 5 minutes, it is incredibly grim. Things are moving so rapidly in the opposite direction.
I think you're wrong.
Okay.
So, the right is having its moment now. And it's actually making a lot of headway with what it can do with the federal government and the courts without Congress. But it's not getting a lot through Congress, except this huge tax thing, and they still may lose. But what has happened, though, is that, the traditional stranglehold of the Democratic Party policy agenda, by what you could call the corporate Democrats and their friends, has been broken. And people are situating themselves, the center-left policymakers have moved much closer to where the Economic Policy Institute has always been. And so the next wave of of candidates and the next wave of legislation that'll come, you know, if and when the Democrats achieve, you know, have electoral victories, we will do a lot better than under the, either the Clinton era or the Obama era.
Give me one good example of that.
Well, the discussion about single payer. I personally think the discussion should be about universal coverage and not any particular, you know, imagination about you know, the government providing all directly all the health insurance. But you know, that's a symbol, the symbol of people talking about a job guarantee, the agreement to pursue a $15 minimum wage in 2024, which united both the Sanders and Ellison and the mainstream Democrat position around a $15 proposal. That's pretty huge. The Senate just put out a policy agenda to rebuild collective bargaining that had quite extensive proposals. I mean, repealing Taft-Hartley provisions, such as not allowing right-to-work states, you know, providing a federal law to provide collective bargaining for all public employees, et cetera, et cetera. Things that people haven't been talking about for quite a while. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was endorsed by the Democratic caucus. So it wasn't just a few progressive friends in the Senate. That was Chuck Schumer's list. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot more in there that were really quite substantial reforms. Yes, I think, you know, you will see the Economic Policy Institute emerge as a much more important source of policy proposals, and others, you know, that were aligned with Hillary Clinton and such, you know, less so, you know, that they are be more in the past than in the future. I think that's exciting, and our time will come again. You know, there may be a Democratic House in 2019, and who knows about the Senate. And, you know, nothing's for sure, but it's not as grim as, you know, we'll never get, you know, the Democrats will never get back.
Well, let me ask you, since you made a point of saying that you're not going to disappear, what of the areas of research that are out there, I mean, what's the thing that you really want to sink your teeth into?
Well, a number of things, but one, I want to tell the narrative about how wages were suppressed. And it wasn't suppressed simply by globalization, and it's not because workers don't have adequate skills. It's because of policy changes that work against workers. It has been, as Josh Bivens' book was titled, Failure by Design. You know, wage stagnation is not an accident. It's a product of conscious decisions that have been made to suppress the labor movement, to suppress the minimum wage, to keep unemployment excessively high, to erode labor standards. So that needs to be told. I want to do research on the upper 1%, you know, and who they are and how they've changed over the last 40 years. There's an emerging debate about, you know, whether it's, you know, occupations like doctors and lawyers, you know, getting various so-called rents, or is it something else? I think it's the something else. Mm-hmm. I think it's the financial sector, and I think it's the executives.
How does Silicon Valley play into this in your mind?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And one of the things that we're going to be working on is how to understand the increased power of corporations, both in the technology space, but also in terms of their monopoly power, what role has that played? So that's an important research. I've spent a lot of time on issues that tend to be labeled the future of work, some of which shouldn't be included in the future of work, such as the gig economy. There's so much attention to things like Uber as if that's the wave of future employment. In fact, Uber, I don't have anything for this recent year or two, but in 2015, the wages paid to all Uber drivers comprised about 0.1% of all wages. It's really small thing. Mm-hmm. And the whole gig economy would be just a little bit bigger than that. And maybe it's gotten bigger since. But the fact is that the gig economy is mostly people who are earning extra money on top of their other types of employment. And you can't label something the future of work if it's not the main way that people earn a living. The reason people work is they have to support themselves. It's not about their side jobs.
Yeah, but there is this larger thing that you've been concerned about with, and you alluded to it earlier, misclassified workers.
Yes,
people who
yes,
are,
there is all that. Yeah, so there's the fissured economy, as talked about by David Weil, and there's the more people becoming subcontracted and temporary and misclassified, and there's a lot of that goes on. Absolutely. Uber and Lyft are poster childs of misclassification because those workers really are employees, and it's only through the efforts of persistent bullying by Uber that they are able to maintain them as contractors, not employees. Similar with the Federal Express, which has all of its workers as independent contractors.
I believe your Comcast tech person.
Right. They could either be a contractor or they're there's some or some agency, some other firm is subcontracted to do the work. And it's mm-hmm. these are all ways to shift liability, to pursue lower wages. And we have to address all those kinds of issues, for sure.
Right.
But I also, in the future work, the more important question is not, are we all going to become freelancers or Uber workers? I don't really believe that. There may be people in other types of what called alternative work arrangements that are problematic, but that's still a small minority. But there's a lot of discussion about, are robots going to take all our jobs, and is that what we should worry about? And I'm of the believer that, there will be automation, just as there has been for 150 years. And it may accelerate. There's no evidence of any acceleration so far. It may, and we should be concerned about that. But I think it's wrong to postulate that automation will eliminate the number of people working.
Let me tell you what happened, what I did yesterday.
Okay.
I wanted the sausage, biscuit, and egg. So I went down to the McDonald's in my neighborhood, and I went to a kiosk, entered what I wanted, paid with my Apple Pay app, and then stood in line while the couple of cooks in the back delivered my breakfast.
Right.
There were only... I remember when I worked in McDonald's when I was 16 years old, we had like this long row of registers.
Right, right. I understand. There's a lot of people that were doing it.
And so there's a lot fewer people at my neighborhood McDonald's.
Right. So the fact is that other things are happening as well. One is that it probably does increase the need for more cooks. Okay? You probably have, so there may be fewer people to register, but there may be more people cooking behind the scenes. But it's also, the following is also true. The McDonald's didn't do that unless it could provide the products to you at the same cost or cheaper. Mm-hmm. Usually it would be cheaper, okay? So the question is, if you in a year buy a certain amount of McDonald's and it's cheaper because of the kiosks, then you're going to spend less money on McDonald's than you normally would have. Let's say you spent $500 a year, and let's say you now spend four and a quarter, okay, in the future. Well, that's 75 more bucks that you have. Where did that go? You're not saving it for your retirement, right? You're going to spend that.
Yeah.
And where are you going to spend it? Well, I can't tell you where you're going to spend it. I can tell you a few things. If companies know you have that $75 to spend, they're going to find a way to get it. So they're going to find things that you want. And unless you have run out of stuff you want, you're going to spend that 75 bucks. Now, when that 75 bucks, you know, multiplied by millions of people, is going to, create, there's going to be things that are produced, goods, there's going to be services that are going to be sold that will require people to do them.
Well,
that's the dynamic.
This will feed your argument. So in my neighborhood, in the same neighborhood where there is this McDonald's, in the last 4 or 5 years, there have been a proliferation of like mid-range to upper-scale restaurants.
Yeah.
That have one just open near my house, which...
Now, is this a gentrifying neighborhood? Huh? Is this a gentrifying
neighborhood? It's a gentrifying neighborhood.
So there's not an equilibrium here, but yeah.
There's not equilibrium here, but the point is that you know, there's a lot of money sloshing around. You know, the fact that...
And that's what capitalists do, right? They're figuring out how to make sure you spend their money. There's not a lot of idle money by people whose incomes have stagnated, not done well.
Right.
If you have extra money because something is now cheaper than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, yeah, I mean, I'm not against those kiosks. And I'm also not against, you know, I don't want to bring back elevator operators. You know, I want to get rid of bulldozers on construction sites. I mean, I welcome, you know, investment. In fact,
self-driving trucks.
Well, you know, self-driving trucks, we will see. It will be a problem for people, you know, those workers. And I don't want to, you know, diminish that. But it's not true, I think, that if a million people lose jobs in trucking, that there won't be other jobs opening up elsewhere. And I'm not saying, you know, so here's what I think is important. I think it's wrong to focus on we're not going to have enough jobs. And I think it's wrong to focus on providing education and training to those truckers as the solution, as if that will have them, you know, be able to get good jobs. I've spent more than 40 years following what's going on in the manufacturing sector. I'm an ex-economist for both the steelworkers and the auto workers. I know that what has hurt manufacturing workers is they lost those jobs, and it wasn't that they were not given enough education opportunities in community colleges and all. They could have been given more. But it's the fact that there were not other good jobs to go to. You can't solve this problem by educating people into good jobs that may not be there. And how do we get the good jobs? Well, we get the good jobs through the policies that I was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same policies we need to deal with wage stagnation. So what we have to do is, instead of focusing on the robots and the display and the lost jobs, is to make sure that whatever jobs get created are good jobs. So that if people are displaced by technology, automation, we do have something that's worth going to. And I think that's much more important than this mantra of we're either not going to have enough jobs or we have to, you know, give people more education training. I'm all for education training opportunities, but you know, a diploma to nowhere is not all that helpful.
I think that was the conversation that a lot of us were trying to have when we were talking about shifting to a green energy economy,
right?
Where, you know, there is a way that we can create new jobs in a new economy that is also would also help us save the planet.
And what we haven't really figured out how to do is to have those green jobs be good jobs. And I think there's a lot of disappointment that to the extent that there were green jobs created, insulating houses and all that kind of stuff, that the dynamics elsewhere in the economy are present there as well. You have low-wage contractors, and they're not necessarily good union jobs. Or, you know, they could be, but they're not. And, so I think it's really important when people talk about job creation that, there has to be coupled with it some kind of job quality agenda.
What's the parting message for those of us on the left who are now going to have to figure out how to lead the nation out of this policy morass that we're stuck in right now and articulate a different vision of how the economy can work for everyone?
Yeah, so first and foremost, there will be lots of income produced over the next few decades. The challenge is how to build an economy that allows everybody to benefit from that growing economy. And, what has happened in the past four decades is not because there was not growth or there was not an increase in the output of goods and services per hour worked, which we call productivity. It was that didn't translate into rising, wages and benefits for the vast majority. So the optimism is, it's not as if there's an economy that's broken. It wasn't broken. It was designed not to get to the vast majority. Those are different things. And people walk around as if we have a bad economy. We don't have a bad economy. We have a bad, it's been built to do what it is doing, which is skimming the best, the most for those at the top. And so that should be heartening, that it's a matter of organizing, of policy, of politics, of mobilization. Now, is that easy? No. There's the power of money in politics that has to be addressed. But, the people can win. The people have won at various points. The people can win. And, it's not difficult to develop ways that people can win in the economy if, in fact, they are, their leaders focus on that and they hold their leaders accountable. So I look forward to being part of that process moving forward, and I'm very confident that the Economic Policy Institute will be front and center in that dynamic.
Well, thank you for sharing your time.
Well, thank you.